Hey guys, Bill here. We're going to get to the show, talk about the NBA playoffs here in a second. But first, wanted to talk about Dollar Shave Club. And I mean, you know Dollar Shave Club if you listen to podcasts. It's not exactly a new product. Dollar Shave Club is going to give you a clean, comfortable, amazing, affordable shave. You already know that. I'm not here to tell you what you already know. I'm here to tell you about the stuff you need to know now, which is that Dollar Shave Club is about more than razors and shaving. Everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best, you can get at DollarShaveClub.com because they're going to deliver shampoo, they're going to deliver body wash, they're going to deliver toothpaste, and yeah, all that other stuff you already know Dollar Shave Club has, all the razors, all the Dr. Carver shave butter, anything you need to look and feel your best, Dollar Shave Club is going to send to you. You don't have to go to the store. You don't have to wait online at big box store or overly expensive convenience store getting razors, getting shampoo, getting toothpaste. You're not going to have to bag your own stuff and call someone over when the automated machine doesn't work. That's not part of your life anymore with DollarShaveClub.com because they're going to send it to you. It's going to show up in your mailbox. It's going to help you look great. It's going to help you smell great. It's going to help you feel great. And if you join Dollar Shave Club today and spend $5, not a lot, $5, you probably have $5 in your couch right now, you're going to get free shipping and you're going to get the 6-blade executive razor and trial sizes of shave butter, body cleanser, and the One Wipe Charlies. What a good deal that is. If you don't know what a One Wipe Charlie is, you should probably spend the $5 and find out because it's going to be pretty impressive. $5, 6-blade executive razor, trial size shave butter, trial size body cleanser, trial size One Wipe Charlie, and then the blades are going to keep coming for a few dollars per month. So no more trips to the store, no more waiting in line, just razors, One Wipe Charlies, whenever you need them. You're going to be lousy with One Wipe Charlies in your apartment. And to do that, just go to DollarShaveClub.com/Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, DollarShaveClub.com/Barnwell, and you'll get all that for $5 in free shipping. 6-blade executive razor, shave butter, body cleanser, One Wipe Charlie, $5 free shipping, DollarShaveClub.com/Barnwell. Here's the show. Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. It's Wednesday, April 25th, 2018. NFL Draft is coming up tomorrow. We're going to have some draft coverage coming for you on Friday after the first round of the draft is completed. But here, have to admit, I'm pretty sick of the draft. I don't want to sit here and talk about Josh Allen's high school completion percentage. So I decided I'm not doing a football show today. I decided I wanted to do a basketball show, talk about the NBA playoffs. And joining me to do that is someone who will apparently just appear on any ESPN podcast if you ask him, Dan Devine of Yahoo Sports. Dan, how are you?
Well, I'm a little bit ticked off because now I have to get rid of my 15 minutes of Josh Allen high school tape material that I had prepared for today. I thought we were doing something different, but I guess we'll do my regular job. And the second part is I'm a little bit, I feel a little bit, sort of slighted here. I mean, listen, it's not that I'll show up on any show. It's that, you know, when good friends of mine who I've known for many years ask me to do their shows, I feel compelled to do it. And I have the listening audience know the first thing I did when I talked to you after I did Zach Lowe's podcast was say, I hope this does not bar me from future appearances on the Bill Barnwell Show. And what did you tell me, Bill Barnwell?
I said you are banned from the Bill Barnwell Show.
Banned! Banned! I was banned. And luckily for me, very, very kindly, you reconsidered, so that banning only lasted a few short days.
Well, Dan, you know, I have a reputation as someone who is quite comfortable blocking people on Twitter. You should not be surprised I would block someone on the podcast, but you are a basketball expert, someone I turn to for analysis of the NBA. And so I saw a very exciting set of games over the last few days that you were the first person I thought of. You were the person I needed to go to talk about the NBA. And as someone who's located on the East Coast, someone who's very comfortable talking about the Philadelphia 76ers, who advanced past the first round of the playoffs last night. So let me start with this. Is the process over? Or is that part of that conversation about the Sixers where they are rebuilding? Is that done now?
I think it's fair to say that the rebuild is over. Like, they now have Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons and for the, you know, as long as those guys are operational, like healthy and in one piece, this team should be competitive and, you know, at least in the Eastern Conference and perhaps beyond, like as long as one of those guys are operational, definitely as long as they both are, and maybe even either or at this point, because that's how good those guys have been to this point this season. But I think it's like they're done rebuilding because they have the core of their team, but they're not done building. And so that's the thing. I think it's sort of interesting, you know, looking at where we go now. Like, this wasn't supposed to be, quote unquote, the year for the Sixers. This was like the year that they were supposed to get a good look at who they were going to be, but not really the finished product, because, you know, they still have six more picks coming in this year's draft, two more first rounders, including a possible top 10 pick coming from the Lakers, which, you know, it's crazy to trace those things back. Like, it went from the Lakers to the Phoenix Suns for Steve Nash seven lifetimes ago, and then wound up getting redirected to the Sixers in the three-way deal for that landed Michael Carter-Williams in Milwaukee in 2015, and now that could turn into a top 10 pick for the Sixers in 2018, which is mind-blowing to think about how that, you know, these sort of sliding doors transactions go. They have a bunch of second-round picks too. They could have four picks in the top 40 of the draft. And then beyond that, about $25 million in cap space, which they could even blow that up into like $32-33 million if they could find a way to get off Jared Bayless' deal for next year or make some other moves. They could get into the conversation for a max-level salary slot should a certain all-NBA, all-time caliber wing become available. And they've already begun the recruitment process with billboards for that person. And they also have Markelle Fultz, who's 19 years old, you know, the number one pick in the draft, who basically redshirted this season and, you know, showed some flashes at the end of the year. You know, might not be, you know, the starting point guard of the future on a team that has Ben Simmons, but, you know, is a guy that can continue to elevate that ceiling. So, like, there's all this raw material still to continue to add on to what's already a pretty scary and frightening core, and that's, you know, sort of what Brett Brown was talking about after they won game five, knocked out Miami. Is like, there's still so much more room for this team to grow internal development wise and then also in terms of what they can continue to add to this core. And so, like, you know, they have a direction and an identity. They've, you know, built that foundation, and now it's just sort of, you know, what accessories they're going to add on to it.
I mean, it's sort of scary to think that, like you said, this is a team that was not supposed to be a finished product, certainly has room to expand, and yet look at the last 21 games, they've won 20 of those games, which is good. 20 out of 21 is really good. And that was without, for a good chunk of time, Joel Embiid. So, I mean, granted, it wasn't the toughest schedule over the end, towards the end of the season. The Heat aren't necessarily the toughest postseason opponent, but is there something specific that's changed about them over the last month of the year that's turned them into suddenly, you know, at the very least, the Eastern Conference version of the Jazz, if not the NBA juggernaut that a 20-1 team seems to be?
Yeah, I think it's worth remembering that late season schedule. Like, you know, they had a pretty cheesy cheesecake run of it going in. Like, it was not a complicated slate down the stretch, but and you know, they were still fighting for playoff position though, and you know, the games that they needed to win against playoff competition, where they needed to beat the Cavs to lock up or to get in position for the number three seed, they needed to knock off the Bucks the last couple days of the season there. They did that. They took care of their business. But I think the biggest thing for me down the stretch was really, as you mentioned, they played that time without Joel Embiid, and they really learned that they can play without him. That they are, you know, and maybe that doesn't necessarily hold against, you know, a top, you know, Final Four caliber of opponent, but they know they have something that works there, where they can, you know, when Embiid went down with the broken orbital bone, you know, they over the last like month and a half of the season, even before he went down, but you know, extending through the first round here, they've outscored opponents by about 9 points per 100 possessions without Embiid on the floor, and that's a huge number. That's like, you know, best in the NBA caliber net rating over the course of a full season, and that's, you know, some of that is schedule, some of that's opponent, but some of that is that they've found stuff that works. Where, like, if they go four out offense, where there's, you know, one traditional big man and then, you know, sort of four perimeter players, and they plug in Amir Johnson at the center in place of Joel Embiid, you know, obviously he's not the, you know, the offensive weapon that Joel Embiid is. He's not the defensive game changer, but he, you know, is a sort of a solid veteran defender who helps people get organized. He can protect the rim a little bit. He can defend the basket and, you know, clean the defensive glass. set screens, you know, be in smart places. And when they have shooters around the floor with Simmons running the show, they can score enough to, you know, continue to hold their own with those sorts of lineups. They were sort of forced to play more five out with Ersan Ilyasova, who they picked up off the buyout market at center in place of Embiid, and they found that works too. You know, you can pull an opposing big man away from the basket, as they did at the beginning of the series against Miami with Hassan Whiteside, basically playing him off the floor, because if you've got a lumbering big man who's got to defend on the perimeter, if he can't get out there, Ilyasova will knock down open shots. If he can get out there, it creates more room inside for Simmons to operate. And if you're you start screening and, you know, mucking up matchups on the outside there too, eventually you're going to pop free a J.J. Redick or a Robert Covington or, you know, Marco Bellinelli. One of these shooters is going to get open out there, and they're able to knock down shots with those sorts of lineups too. So as long, I mean, the all of which is a roundabout way of saying they found out that Simmons can be the focal point. Like, it can be like the unquestioned focal point of that team on both ends of the floor, even if Embiid's not around. And that really, I think, it winds up being sort of an additive effect, a multiplier, and like a confidence boost for everybody, because at the beginning of the season, and all throughout last year, the Sixers were trash whenever Embiid was not on the floor. At the beginning of the season, the numbers were awful whenever Embiid was not on the floor, even if Simmons was. That trend started to reverse over the season, and then over the course of the last few weeks, it really like kicked into overdrive, where Simmons was just dominating with no matter who he was on the floor with. That carried through into round one, and then midway through the series, they get him back. He's just starting to knock the rust off, and everybody else also knows how they can play without him. So it's the Sixers found out that they've got a couple of different speeds they can go to. They've got a couple of different looks they can offer, and that they can go toe-to-toe with just about anybody in both of those circumstances.
So you think in the long term for the Sixers, maybe this changes, you know, perhaps some of their lineups where they are more comfortable having stretches where it is just one of Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid on the court. They don't have to worry about having both those guys on the court for the majority of minutes, perhaps, when Embiid's healthy.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I think that, you know, it's instructive to look at, you know, the way that that Houston operates with James Harden and Chris Paul, right? Now, obviously different players, different size, different role definitions, but part of the argument for going and getting Chris Paul was that no matter what happened, you were going to have a Hall of Fame caliber offensive focal point on the floor all the time. And, you know, instead of it was going to lighten the workload on James Harden, and it was going to make sure that your team didn't just crater whenever your best player hit the bench. And, you know, having Embiid, who you can run everything out of the post and the elbows with him, and who continues to get better as a passer, and, you know, seeing, you know, where to move the ball out of double teams, that kind of stuff, is only going to get better the more reps he gets, especially with the floor space with the shooters that Philly has. And Simmons, who now has proven he can, you know, be a sort of an offense unto himself, or a system unto himself running that offense. It would make sense to me, especially given Embiid's injury history and the fact that these guys have both had foot issues in the past, like, rather than saying we're going to, you know, run them both out there for giant minutes all the time, take advantage of the fact that you can, you know, blow teams' doors off in the minutes that you have them both on the floor, and then also find ways to continue to operate, a few minutes at a time with only one of them on there. I think it would seem to be a smart allocation of resources, but obviously in the short term, they want to get as much time as they can with those guys together, because they haven't had a whole lot of opportunity to do it through the first couple of years of their careers.
Right, and you'd figure, you know, maybe not in this postseason, but actually, let me ask you about that now that I think about it, because Markel Fultz obviously is going to have to eventually carve out a role on this team, and you figure, you know, maybe he's going to play a role where when Ben Simmons sits, he's almost always on the floor and handling the ball. And, well, in the course of this Heat series, he played 9 minutes over the course of the entire series, none after game two. You know, T.J. McConnell kind of played that role as the backup point guard and took the minutes where Simmons was off the court. Over the course of this postseason, obviously Fultz is going to play a bigger role in the months to come, but in the weeks to come in this postseason, do you think Markel Fultz is going to have a role on this team, or is it just going to be a thing where the Sixers are going to stick with, you know, what's working until perhaps maybe they struggle and maybe then they turn to Fultz for a few minutes here or there?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect that. It wouldn't surprise me if Brett Brown went back to him, you know, sort of, you know, maybe early in the next series, just to kind of see, just to give it a shot and see how it looks. Because I think he liked what he saw from Fultz over the last few weeks of the season, once he made his comeback after having spent most of, you know, 5 months on the shelf. I think he liked the fact that Fultz, with his size, you know, 6'4", with the wingspan, could defend both, you know, the one and the two spots, you know, could switch some screens. I think he liked the fact that even without Fultz being, you know, having the confidence in the jumper and being able to prove to defenses that he could make the jumper, that he still sort of ate up space and attacked the basket and proved capable of getting into the lane and to make plays for others. I think he's, you know, he enjoyed, you saw some of the potential that could be there for Fultz in those games. But those games, again, you know, we could go back to that schedule point. We also have to remember that that sort of late season burst came against, you know, a lot of teams that were out of the running or that, you know, weren't necessarily going to be game planning for him. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's kind of like extended spring training, right, or extended preseason for him at that point, trying to knock the rust off and just get some rhythm together, get some, you know, some reps under his belt. They can't really let him work through stuff in, you know, the Eastern Conference semifinals or beyond. They like the margin of error against good opponents with, well, you know, well coached, well prepared teams that are going to just go under everything. They're going to completely try to muck up the defensive side of the floor by, you know, giving him acres of space. And the fact that he's, you know, 6'4" and not 6'10" and can't attack it like Simmons can, just eat up that space and, you know, get right to the front of the rim for his own shot. I think it presents some more spacing issues. It presents some problems. And you know, while Fultz can be a really interesting defensive player with his size and athleticism and a guy who could kind of, like, in case of emergency, break glass, maybe, you know, go off for a few buckets at a time, he's 19 years old, right? You know, I think you want to relying on that guy too much in the heat of, you know, the high-level playoff series, I think is probably something that Brett Brown's not really ready to do yet. You know, they spent so much time rebuilding Fultz's confidence and getting him back to the point where he was going to be able to get back on the court. I think the last thing they want to do is jeopardize that now.
Yeah, makes sense. From the Heat perspective, I will say there was a play in this game where James Johnson appeared to knock someone out of bounds. I think he was teed up for it. After the play, in the immediate aftermath, nobody on the Sixers went up to James Johnson and wanted any, even to suggest for a moment that there might be a possible fight brewing. Is there anyone else in the league besides James Johnson who you think would have elicited that level of respect / fear from the opposing team in a possible, you know, shoving match situation?
I mean, my answer for this for a number of years has been David West. I feel like people do not want it with David West. He is a grown ass man who is a very serious dude. I think Zach Randolph is a good answer for that because people do not want those hands, and Zach Randolph has established in the past that he is good with those hands. But all that considered, James Johnson's the only one that I'm aware of who has, like, an actual MMA and kickboxing record that does not feature losses on it and does feature wins. And so that is a very scary proposition for, I think, anybody to walk into. Now, there's been sort of a roiling discussion throughout the series, especially through Philly Twitter and through the Sixers Twitter. I believe it's Kyle Newbeck of the Philly Voice that sort of brought up, like, you know, every time James Johnson gets in somebody's face, they bring it up like he's going to go and, you know, roundhouse kick somebody in the face in the middle of the court. Granted, I don't think that we expect that to be true, but fractional percent of a possibility that it could happen, that he could just sort of like pivot and then savate kick a dude in the neck. I think that's it's enough to make me want to just sort of, all right, I'm going to slow down, I'm going to back off. And you saw Embiid in that situation too, just kind of be like, all right, man, everybody take it easy, everybody take it easy. That struck me as the smart move in that situation. You're about to win the series, you're about to move on. You don't really want to, you know, mess anything up with potential suspensions or issues beyond that, and you certainly don't want to do it against a dude who has an actual kickboxing background.
Well, let me ask you now. I did not prepare this question for you, but I do feel like you are a qualified person to ask it. Do you think Sweet Chin Music, the Shawn Michaels superkick, is the most likely WWE finisher to be employed in on an NBA court at any given time?
I mean, do we consider the Big Show's weird big punch a finisher? should we consider that? I'm pretty sure Zach Randolph actually chokeslammed Blake Griffin once or twice, so maybe that's the answer. I should preface this by saying I don't want to see it.
Sure.
But it may be a little bit of sort of crossover. The sort of rolling elbow, the roaring elbow that, you know, Chris Hero, a.k.a. Cassius Ohno, has used, a guy who wears a ton of, like, modified throwback basketball jerseys, that seems like it could happen. You know, in fact, I think, the other night, Jay Crowder sort of inadvertently threw one at Steven Adams, and he no-sold it.
Yes.
But I think, you know, elbows and sort of, you know, general weird punches, I think, are sort of the most likely finishers that you would see. Maybe we could pretend someone has a loaded glove on. Like Marcus Smart right now is walking around with a splint on his hand. You know, we could sell that storyline as perhaps like, oh, he's got something hidden in that splint. We could sort of do something like that.
Well, I will say, now that you bring up Marcus Smart in that splint, was there something in that splint? Because he played very well in his return. Pretty well. Maybe not as well as it might have seemed at first glance, but I think he played pretty well, all things considered, coming back from an injury in the Celtics' win last night. They went up 3-2 in the series. Do you think this was a game that, given the turnovers, and that's, I think, the big thing for me, given that Al Horford turned the ball over 6 times, Marcus Smart, granted, like we said, with a splint on his hand, turned the ball over 5 times, 17 turnovers for the Celtics that turned into 11 points for the Bucks. Do you think this is a game where the Bucks look back and say, man, we should have come away with this one, you know, given what we saw from the Celtics on offense in this game?
I think there's certainly an argument for it. It's so hard to really gauge the Bucks, and maybe, you know, this might be a failing of mine as opposed to sort of one that, you know, more generally about the team, but I feel like I continue to struggle to get a grasp on who they're really supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you look at the times where they play with Giannis at the five, and it makes sense to do that, but then the numbers are not necessarily great in those alignments and haven't been, so that's why at points in the series, it causes defensive issues. You saw some of that last night where, I don't know if it's that Joe Prunty doesn't necessarily trust Giannis defensively at the five against Horford, you know, like feeling like they got to send double teams, which opens up shots on the perimeter and, you know, passing lanes, and that a Brad Stevens team is just going to, like, make those passes every time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's with the roster composition, you feel like you've got to get another big man out there, you know, Zeller when he's healthy, or, you know, John Henson when he's healthy, or mm-hmm. Zeller, or Don McCurr, you know, those sorts of different guys. I'm not sure if it's just sort of that, you know, the wings are not really there in the way that they want them to be, but I think, you know, there are plenty of... they feel like a really tough team for me to get a beat on beyond they have the best player in the series. And I think that seems like it might be true for the team as well, kind of like what they're supposed to be and what the best deployment of all those resources are. And I think that results in a frustrating night like last night where, yeah, the Celtics could be had. I mean, all series long, really, the Celtics kind of could be had. Their young guys are playing sort of not necessarily over their head, because I think a lot of us think the world of Jaylen Brown and mm-hmm. Jason Tatum, sure. Have a lot of respect for what Terry Rozier has built himself into. But it feels like a Celtics team that has struggled all year to score without Kyrie Irving on the floor could be had if you could string together enough good stretches of ball. And then you just go through two periods where it's turnovers and it's, you know, empty possessions. And why isn't Malcolm Brogdon playing even a second in the fourth quarter if he's one of your best 3-point shooters? You know, you're leaning on Shabazz Muhammad a lot, and, you know, you're sort of trying to recapture the spark that you know, Thon McCourt gave them in the third game of the series, but he really had a rough go of it in game four. So, like, there's sort of not a great level of fingertips for what that team needs at any given time. And I think, yeah, that results in a frustrating loss where you look back and you say, there were a number of points where we could have really taken control. And if we hadn't, you know, if the Bucks hadn't fallen into like a 16-point hole early, mm-hmm. You know, they wouldn't have had to spend all that time trying to come back and never really getting over the hump. But there were definitely chances for them to take control of the series, and just went by the wayside. So now they've got to sort of fight for their lives and hope to push it back to a game seven.
I mean, isn't this just sort of the reality of you fired your coach in January and you're still trying to figure out what kind of team you are, especially with, you know, a young team that hasn't really had all their, you know, contributors on the court for really very much time at all over the last few years?
Yeah, I think there's certainly something to that. I would imagine if you were, you know, you were to ask the, you know, the Bucks front office, although, you know, that has also shifted over the last year or so. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bucks ownership or Bucks, certainly Bucks fans, like, you'd want to have a better sense of where you are as an organization and what sort of identity you're developing by this point in Giannis's career. Just, you know, knowing how valuable an asset he is and how valuable a piece, you know, like, you know, there aren't a whole lot of players who can impact the game as many ways and to as great a degree as he can. And yet it still feels like, you know, sort of trying to, you know, there's a lot more question marks than I think you would hope in that situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fact that, you know, the reality is you move on from Jason Kidd in the middle of the season and you elevate, you know, one of his assistants. It's unlikely you're going to completely overhaul an identity at that point. But there's also been a large number of questions about the identity that had been fostered over the previous couple of years, which is why Jason Kidd lost the gig, you know, right? So it's, or one of the reasons Jason Kidd lost the gig. So there's, I think the hope is there's you just can out-talent a diminished Boston team over the course of seven games. Mm-hmm. But when when Giannis gets 10 shots and you're not necessarily playing all of your best players at the best time, at the most important times for long stretches, it can be difficult to do that. And one or two breaks don't go your way, and you find yourself a couple of possessions down late and unable to get back to over the hump. So I think you're right. There's to some degree, this is just sort of the way that things have been going for the Bucks and the way where they are as an organization right now. Mm-hmm. That's why I would imagine that's going to be one of the biggest questions moving forward. Like, with all due respect to Joe Prunty, they are probably going to hold a wide open search for the next coach of that team. And mm-hmm. They're going to have to figure out what are we moving forward, and what's the roster that we're going to build around Giannis to try to get there.
I mean, do you think they can win games in the playoffs against defenses as good as the Celtics with Giannis just taking 10 shots? Because it wasn't like, I can't sit here and say watching that game he played poorly. He just didn't shoot a lot. I mean, it seems like, obviously your ideal scenario is him shooting a ton and winning, winning that way. And he's going to be their, most effective scorer in a lot of cases. But, I mean, can they win with him really more as a distributor than as the primary scorer in this offense?
I mean, it's just going to be tough, and it's not going to be pretty a whole lot of times. I think that, a lot of this series has not been pretty, but, if you're going to get good stretches, the recipe for it is kind of, to some degree, what they had last night, where, you get some good stretches of play and, sort of bursts of scoring from Jabari Parker. You get a sort of a surprise burst from Shabazz Muhammad off the bench in the third quarter. You get, Eric Bledsoe has very much been a trick-or-treat dude throughout this series, but if you get a few moments of attacking from him in places where he can get to the rim, mm-hmm. Wreak a little bit of havoc, that can unsettle a defense. Chris Middleton can make shots, and then led the team with 23 points last night, needed 21 shots to get there, saw a lot of Marcus Smart on his route to that, but is a legit shot maker that they have to account for. It's just, you can't, if you're only going to have your best player handle, take 10 shots. And granted, a lot of that, and Frank Madden, formerly of Brew Hoop, the SB Nation blog on the Bucks, and of the mm-hmm. Locked On Bucks podcast, mentioned this last night. Like, a lot of that's on Giannis. Giannis was muscled up a little bit in the post, dealing with Horford, dealing with Semi Ojeleye, different matchups that he had to handle, and sort of get through post ups, and then in the middle of the possession, kind of get up in the air and kick it out, or look like he had an open shot, but then move out of it. So some of that is he's got to just seize the moment when he gets it, mm-hmm. but some of it is, playing through other people at times when maybe you don't need, three other players should not wind up with more shots than Giannis Antetokounmpo on this iteration of the Bucks. It just shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And that's, whether that's on him or on Joe Prunty or a combination of the both, they kind of need to address that back in Milwaukee to make sure that they're giving themselves the best shot to extend it to a game seven. But they can win that way. They have to be absolutely locked in on defense, and they've got to take advantage of every Boston mistake, because Celtics aren't going to typically are not going to make a ton of them, and they're going to they're going to force you to beat them rather than they're going to beat themselves.
Yeah, I mean, you can't turn 17 turnovers into 11 points. You can't go 9 of 33 from three when Giannis doesn't even take a three pointer during the game. You kind of have to take advantage of your opportunities. Running back to the Sixers here before we get to break. I mean, given what we've seen from these two teams over the first five games, do you think there's a matchup the Sixers want? Would they rather play the Bucks at this point than play, this limited, still winning, but pretty limited version of the Celtics?
That's a really fascinating question, because my immediate answer is I think they'd rather see the Bucks, because the Bucks are just not organized enough to win a series against a team with that kind of top-level talent. Mm-hmm. Then again, it introduces a situation where instead of you knowing you have the two best players in the series, there's a question, because Giannis can just do basically anything on the court. I think I would imagine if they had their druthers, they'd rather see Milwaukee, just because it's such a scattershot team, and they can go into the tank for long stretches. And mm-hmm. Philly's proven against Miami that if you're not a team that's going to be on it and able to generate points consistently, they can just run away from you. But that said, moving from the Miami series to a matchup with Boston, it would be sort of similar in that you know, there's not an elite individual scoring threat that you have to game plan against. Right. You've got, you know, guys who are going to move the ball and are going to try to, like, you know, get multiple, you know, multiple actions on given possession and try to address it. You know, many hands make light work kind of offense, and a physical defense that, you know, will have a lot of sort of options to throw at Simmons, you know, whether it's, you know, and probably in the same way that the you know, Boston defends Giannis with, like, Al Horford and Ojale and, you know, some Marcus Morris and Jaylen Brown for possession here or there, you know, Marcus Smart to create some chaos, all those sorts of things. There's a lot of bodies they can kind of throw to sort of gum up the works for Simmons. But you know, Horford will probably be as adept as anyone is sort of going to be able to be with doing what he can with Embiid. But my guess would be that they'd rather have Milwaukee, but they might be sort of more prepared for a Boston series at this point than they might have been, you know, in round one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense to me. As we hit break, I have a stat for you, Dan. According to Adam Himmelsbach of the Boston Globe, last night's advanced box score reveals that the fastest player in that game by average speed, 4.74 miles per hour, Tyler Zeller.
Well, I think we can all agree, Zellers never stop sprinting. That's one thing we know about them. They're constant motion, forever on the court. That's funny. When I watch the game, I don't necessarily think, wow, the breathtaking speed on Tyler Zeller. But what we can do now is we can get him to go through the draft combine and see what his 40 time would look like, what his three cone looks like, and how he would line up next to Josh Allen. Maybe we can do that in the break.
Well, I wasn't going to get to NFL draft discussion, and I'm still not going to get to NFL draft discussion. You can't convince me. We're going to hit a break and do more basketball afterwards here on the Bill Barnwell Show. First, guys, we're talking about the NBA playoffs here. And if you're a fan of a team like, say, the Utah Jazz, a few months ago, you didn't really think you were going to be doing much in the postseason if you even got there. But now, looks like the Jazz are about to win a playoff series against the Oklahoma City Thunder. Looks like, for example, in the East, another team that's gotten hot in recent weeks, the Philadelphia 76ers, we talked about in the first segment of the show. Well, suddenly, they have some home games that are going to be pretty interesting when it comes to the playoffs. You can trust the process or be over the process and chant something else at home in a meaningful playoff series for the first time in a few years. And you can do that with our partners at SeatGeek, because if you don't have tickets to those games, which you probably don't, you can get tickets with SeatGeek and know you're getting the best possible deal for the best possible seats you're going to want for any given playoff game, any given sporting event in general, and I'm not going to lie, any concert, any event you want to go to, SeatGeek is going to sell you tickets. And they're going to be a good deal because SeatGeek gets tickets from all over the web. They use their deal score technology, so they rate the tickets so you know you're getting the exact deal you want in the exact section you want with tickets that are going to be reliable. You're going to get to go to the game, you're going to have a good time, and you're going to have great seats. And even better, you're going to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase if you use my promo code, which is Barnwell, Barnwell. Use that promo code in the SeatGeek app. Make your first purchase, you're going to get $20 back. So, hey, look at Game 5 if you're a Jazz fan in the Oklahoma City area tonight. Jazz Thunder, $32 to get into the Chesapeake Energy Arena. So that could be $12 if you happen to use the promo code Barnwell and get $20 off that first SeatGeek purchase. I use SeatGeek. It's phenomenal when I want to go to games. I'm not going to lie, I should probably just use my press pass, but I have to be honest with you, I never do. I really honestly use SeatGeek all the time, and it's always been a good deal for me. So join me, join the millions who have purchased tickets using SeatGeek and using this promo code Barnwell, Barnwell. Get $20 back off your first SeatGeek purchase today. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined again by Dan Devine of Yahoo Sports. We are breaking down the Eastern Conference playoffs here in the NBA. We covered the first two series. Now we got two series that are tied. Perhaps surprisingly in some cases, although they've been very close series, I think, on the whole altogether, even if every individual game hasn't been close in the Raptors-Wizards series, but Cavs-Pacers, I mean, it's not, you know, 2-2 might be fair, but it's also not crazy to imagine a scenario where the Pacers have swept the Cavs in this series. I mean, Victor Oladipo misses an open three to tie the game late in game two. Pacers had a lead late in game four and blew it. I mean, it seems crazy to think of in a series with LeBron, but is it fair to say the Pacers look like the better team of these two right now?
I think it is fair to say that, and I think it has been true basically since the opening jump of the series. You know, if not for a sort of ridiculous opening to Game 2 from LeBron, and if not for some tight play down the stretch from the Pacers in Game 4, this is, you know, Indiana has had you know, sort of the better of the run of play almost throughout. That said, I think that we can't pretend like those things didn't happen or they don't matter. And like the Pacers, I think will you know, could very well come to really rue the missed opportunities of, you know, not only that Oladipo, the open three missed at the end of Game 2, but you know, Nate McMillan going away from him, with early foul trouble in that game because they just got, I think it was minus 11 in the minutes he was off the floor. Now there, there have been a lot of discussion as to how coaches manage foul trouble, and Ben Falk, Cleaning the Glass, had a really great piece about the different factors that go into discussing when you're going to sit your star player down and foul trouble and all these sorts of things. There's a lot of considerations that go into it, but there was sort of an opportunity for the Pacers to kind of step on the Cavs' necks, and they blinked a little bit, you know. And then again, you see that in game, they get the crazy Bojan Bogdanović game in Game 3 to go back on top, and again, Game 4, the chance to kind of grab the series by the scruff of its neck, and you know, they don't. And that's, this is not a particularly analytical point of view, I suppose, but it sort of just feels like if you don't, kill the villain in the monster movie when you get the chance, you're going to keep seeing him in the final reel, right? Like, he's just going to keep showing up and keep showing up and keep showing up, and you can't give a LeBron James team this many chances to get back into it. The Pacers have done very little to inspire doubt in this series. You know, they have proven to be every ounce worth the billing in this series, and they have. To me, I think you're right. They've looked like the better team throughout. The ability to take advantage of those opportunities when they arise also matters. And we'll see this whole thing could change after Game 5 if they go out there and they grab the series with two hands again. But it just feels like they're creating a situation where they could wind up kicking themselves quite a bit over the course of the summer here.
Yeah, it certainly seems like that's the case. Now, to be fair, I mean, the Cavaliers not look like they're about to suddenly go into that mode where they are suddenly a dominant team in the playoffs, which maybe kind of figured it might happen during the postseason, but. And over the course of this series so far, they have an 89.1 offensive rating in the second half of games. I mean, Kevin Love is someone who is getting bodied up by Thaddeus Young, who is somehow still under 30. He has an injury that's preventing him from playing at a high level. I mean, do you think we are at a point where maybe the Cavs do have to think about limiting Love's minutes even further and possibly even going back to more Tristan Thompson?
Well, Tristan Thompson definitely makes some sense for the best screen setter they've got. So if they're looking to get LeBron cleaner looks, if they're looking to get the other sort of supplementary ball handlers, guys like Jordan Clarkson or Jose Calderon or George Hill, get those guys an advantage when they're coming off screens, that makes some sense to me. And is sort of creating more daylight than guy like Larry Nance has or than Love's been able to, but they, the things that have been, and if he's able to crank up defensive activity for a few possessions at a time, that's really helpful. Also, when they sort of draw switches or when they're going to try to trap Victor Oladipo, getting more active hands. Like, he just, if nothing else, he knows how to play alongside LeBron in the context of a playoff series. He's got more experience than anybody else, or just about anybody else on the roster in doing it. So that stands to reason. But, trading out Love for Thompson at this point, the offensive ceiling of the Cavs, even with Love having a banged up hand, it's already mitigated. It's already limited, and even just like taking away the threat of the second best scorer on the team feels like we're again going back to that caveman ball style that LeBron had to go to when he had no options at all in the 2015 finals, and like create everything offensively. And, all due respect to Kyle Korver, who's been awesome, but like if he's the second best offensive option on the team, you're in they're in serious trouble. So even the possibility that Kevin Love could be that guy again in this series, I think might be worth continuing to give him the shot, because like you're not gonna get that from Tristan Thompson. You're not gonna get that from Larry Nance. You're not gonna get J.R. Smith is there's forever the possibility that he could just wake up and hit six threes. But you're not getting that elsewhere. So. And you're certainly not getting it from Jeff Green right now, who looked important for them down the stretch of the season as a sort of a malleable front court piece, but has been kind of toxic in the playoffs for the most part. So I don't know. Yeah, it is a shame that the late season injury and then the jammed thumb is limited Love like this. But there aren't a whole lot more attractive options for Ty Lue to turn to, rather than I think just having to say you got to kind of go with your best guys and at least see if it works, see if Love can get a couple to go down and open things up a little bit.
You're not suggesting that the Cavs should turn to more J.R. Smith from three quarters of the court away?
I mean, from an aesthetic perspective, I'm always in favor of J.R. pulling up from wherever he can with whatever's in his hands, whether it's a ball or an appetizer. But I think it's proven. It seems like at this point, there's just not a whole lot of bankable threats to create for the Cavs, and you've seen that they've had difficulty generating stuff when Miles Turner is like hiding out on guards, and they want to try to let Thad Young be there for any LeBron screen and rolls and try to gum up the works of the Cavs offense. JR is not able to really create like that. Jordan Clarkson, he wants to create like that, but they're not really getting a whole lot out of it. Jose Calderon is a ball mover and a guy who's going to shoot when he gets the ball in a catch and shoot, but that's kind of it. There's just not a whole lot of dynamism and creativity. And this was the fear when you traded away Kyrie Irving. Like, when everything breaks down and you need somebody who can go get you buckets, what do you have? And you don't have him anymore. And Isaiah Thomas wasn't that guy, wasn't able to be health-wise this year. And none of the pieces that they brought back, are that guy. Rodney Hood theoretically could be that guy, but he has absolutely not been since he put on a Cavs uniform. You don't know how healthy or what you're going to be, how healthy George Hill will be or what you're going to be able to get from him, so you can't rely on that. And even so, he's not like a dynamic creator. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you just sometimes the best answer really might be saying like, hey, JR, just find out, figure it out. Like, see what you can do. But I don't know if that's one that's going to necessarily generate a whole lot of expected value against a Pacers defense that's been pretty good.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the other thing with, even if they do figure this out, even if LeBron does carry them to a victory this series, I mean, not only was he working a ton during the regular season, but this is now four games with 40-plus minutes for LeBron in a row during the first round of the playoffs. You assume a fifth is on the way, barring a blowout against Indiana. I mean, there's not been time to hide him where you can get him, 10 minutes off during a game. We played 46 minutes on Sunday in that four-point victory. It sort of seems like even if the Cavs do kind of figure out what to do in advance, that you're not going to have a LeBron who's rested enough to play, at that otherworldly LeBron level deep into this postseason.
Yeah, it seems like you're asking an awful lot, which is to some degree nothing new. It's what the Cavs always are, but it's like especially excessive now. And it just doesn't, it doesn't seem like it makes a whole lot of, it doesn't inspire a whole lot of hope. I continue to have a hard time picking the Pacers to win the series just because I need to see a LeBron-led team lose four times to anyone in the East before I will fully believe that that's like even possible at this point. But the Pacers have done their job to take it from the realm of otherworldly, never in a million years to you could squint and understand it happening. And the Cavs have not done a whole lot to push me back in the other direction. I just, the fact that the Pacers didn't take advantage of those opportunities a couple of times still leaves me with a little bit of pause. But, yeah, you're right. Even if the Cavs are able to sort of take care of business at home and, move on out of the series, even if things are shaky in the rest of the East, and they largely are, whoever they would be facing next, that's a little bit of a dicey matchup based on what's happened in the last couple of days here and the other series, the 1-8 series. But it's still... Yeah, it feels like you're just sort of waiting for LeBron and the Cavs to run out of gas, as opposed to wondering when they're going to get revved up.
Have you had, in your lifetime, Daniel Levine, have you ever had a moment as triumphant as Lance Stephenson holding up that jump ball against LeBron James in Game 4?
I've given this a lot of thought, and I feel like, the stock sort of washed dad answer, which is, you know, it is my brand, it is who I am, is like, you know, the first time I held my children, I felt that.
To be clear, hold on. You did not hold your child like Lance Stephenson held the basketball, though.
Well, I certainly am not going to admit to that on a podcast, Bill. You're not supposed to hold children that way, especially newborns. The feeling of triumph that attended me doing that, I could say. Beyond that, I guess, you know, there was a point when the college newspaper that I worked at, the Cowl at Providence College, shouts to all involved in the Cowl office. The section that I wrote for, the arts and entertainment section, won like a best section award. I forget which year it was, but you know, we were considered the best section in the paper. And I accepted the award alongside a colleague of mine named Dave Mayo, where I was wearing a T-shirt on which I had scrawled the phrase A&E is for the children. And Dave, I think, just spouted a whole lot of other Wu-Tang things while I stood next to him holding a small plaque. And that might have been it. I felt very, very confident in myself at that moment. I felt the kind of confidence that you feel for yourself that you only feel when you're like 20 years old and are sure that you know everything and are the best. And in that moment, I was utterly convinced of that. So I guess that might be, I don't know that it's necessarily a good thing that Lance Stephenson seems to live in the space of my confidence when I was 20, but, I guess, you know, I that had to have felt pretty good for him, and that felt pretty good for me too. Although it's one of the sad realizations of like, you probably shouldn't have just been writing stuff on t-shirts that much. I did maybe too much of that when I was younger.
I mean, to be fair, I believe Dave Mayo is an actual Wu affiliate, if I'm not mistaken.
I wish I had the Wu name generator right now to be able to pull up an alias for him. But, shouts to Dave Mayo.
Shouts to Dave Mayo, indeed. Let's finish up. Let's talk about this final series here. Oh, actually, no, I lied. One more Cavs question. Cavs have worn gray suits to Game 3, black suits to Game 4. What do you think the Cavs will be wearing in their walk-in to Game 5?
I feel like they have to stick with the black suits, right? Like, I guess maybe it's considered sort of gauche or a fashion faux pas to wear the same thing, twice. But, you didn't win Game 3 with the gray suits. You won Game 4 with the black suits, and you have to stick with what works, right? You know, whatever the Bull Durham thing, don't mess with the winning streak. One game is not a streak, but I think you have to go with it and prove that you're doubling down on what has worked for you.
I can't imagine, like, if one of my friends bought me a suit, my first question would be, how did this person know what size suit I am? Like, what are the chances this suit's not going to fit because it's super high?
That would be amazing if you see like everybody, you know, or like guys that came through like midseason, like
yes.
Everyone, you know, like the guys that have been there for a long time, like Tristan Thompson's suits fits, J.R. Smith's suit fits, and like Larry Nance Jr. is wearing like high water pants,
right.
And and a jacket that's six sizes too big, and it's like, come on, man. I guess the other option is if we're going from gray suit to black suit, maybe like Royal Tenenbaum style red Adidas tracksuits, maybe like a Chad Tenenbaum style situation. That could be a good look. Although I guess there's a lot of then you run into Nike sponsorship, so there could be some issues there. But I guess as long as everybody's matching, that's really the important thing, right? You want to show everyone that you're together.
Mm-hmm. And they've proven that over the course of the ensuing two games, they're losing and winning as a team. However, in the other series in this game, the Raptors, again, a team that, like the Pacers, might have been able to really put their imprint on this series, had a lead in Game 4, were in great shape, to possibly go to finish the series off in Game 5, and they blew it. They scored 18 points in the fourth quarter. Now things are tied at 2. What happened to the Raptors' offense in the fourth quarter of Game 4?
I mean, you saw sort of the reversion to this is the way we used to play. Like, you know, and part of that is, you know, the confidence that the Raptors have spent all season sort of developing in their second unit, in the, you know, their complementary players, where, you know, those guys were relied upon to get the ball and take those shots and, you know, shoot with confidence because, this is the way the system works. We believe that if we're, you know, if we're moving the ball and moving our bodies and we're getting looks for guys, even if they're not our star players, that's still a better option for us than like just relying heavily on DeMar getting to 20 feet and shooting over whoever's there, or, you know, Kyle Lowry heaving up a three off the bounce against, you know, a trap. And all season long, that has been a good recipe. But in that game, it seemed like those, you know, the complimentary players were maybe a little less ready to score, a little less ready to, or less willing to take those shots, those opportunities when they arose. Sometimes it's just, you know, role players feel more comfortable at home than on the road. You know, Kevin Pelton has mentioned that, you know, like it's because everybody feels more comfortable at home than on the road. So there's no grand mystery to that. But star players are the ones who can transcend that a little bit. And, you know, in the situation, if other guys are not necessarily willing to shoulder the load, DeMar DeRozan's a guy who's going to go out shooting as opposed to go out deferring. So that's, you know, kind of why things can gum up and get bogged down. And if the Wizards then are able to say, like, we'll, you know, we think we can switch everything, keep the ball outside. We're going to, and we believe that if we, you know, allow DeMar DeRozan to come in and shoot a 20 footer, or if that's the best look they get, we feel like we've done our job. And, you know, it becomes quicksand, right? A few of those miss, and then, you know, they're grabbing the ball off the rim and going down the other end. And John Wall in transition is, you know, still a very scary thing. So, it can bring up some sort of bad old memories for the Raptors. And I think what they need to do is just kind of crumple that up and chuck it, and remember what got them to 59 wins here was it can't be, you can't hesitate when the ball comes to you and the ball finds the energy and whatever cliche you want to use. When it gets to you, you've got to put it up. Give your bigs a chance to get the offensive rebound. Give, you know, reward the faith that, you know, DeRozan and Lowry have in you, that they would, you know, make the play for you in that moment. You know, prove to them that the best option, again, is sticking with the program as opposed to saying, I got to go win this myself. And, you know, you get a couple of those to go down, and I think, you know, the collective blood pressure drops and everyone starts to breathe a little bit easier.
I mean, this is a situation where, did they have relapses like this during the season late in games, or is this really the first time they've really gone back to that sort of, you know, two-man hero ball situation all year?
I think it's a good point. I mean, the clutch numbers for them, I don't have them in front of me now, but I'll see if I can pick them up. The clutch numbers for the Raptors were not great all season long. The offense didn't perform exceptionally well in you know, tight late situations. The real strength of the Raptors in this season was that basically they didn't get, you know, they took care of their business before they got there, to a large extent. You know, they have, I got it right here from the NBA.com stats site, the 105.3 points per 100 possessions in 161 sort of clutch minutes defined as the score being within 5 points in the last 5 minutes. And over the course of the full season, the Raptors offense was way, way better than that. You know, they were top five offensive team all season long. Scoring significantly higher than that 105 point something. Yeah, 111 points per 100 possessions over the course of the full season. So the motion did sputter at times. It was a cause of consternation among Raptors fans and among, you know, for Dwayne Casey at times this season, of like, when it gets tight, we, you know, or when, you know, when the game is sort of in the balance, we can get tight and we can, you know, sort of fall back on old habits. And you saw in the first two games of the series that when they trusted it, when they relied on the, you know, moving the ball and taking the shots that were there for them, they were able to sort of out-talent and outclass the Wizards. But if they're not going to do that, it put, you know, it and rely on sort of system and motion and confidence to, you know, create that gap between the two teams, then, you know, the Wizards have the top, you know, the top level talent and Wall and like an engaged Bradley Beal to, you know, pull them sort of back into the series.
I mean, in terms of the lineups here for the Raptors, they did have some success with, of course, I mean, we should preface this by saying Raptors bench over the course of the regular season, one of the best benches, if not in basketball in recent memory, perhaps, when it comes to bench lineups. And Fred VanVleet is injured, has not been playing very much. I think did he play earlier in the series at all?
He played like two minutes in game two, I think. And then, but you know, just didn't feel healthy, didn't feel confident, and hasn't been able to go.
That sounds like me pretty much constantly. So I can empathize with Fred VanVleet there. But, in game four, we saw a little bit of Kyle Lowry with the same four guys as sort of like the Lowry in the bench lineup. Do you think that is a lineup we will see more of from the Raptors, or assuming Fred VanVleet is not able to return in game five?
Yeah, I think to some extent the Raptors kind of have to do, you know, the time has sort of, I think the time has passed for Dwayne Casey to experiment a whole lot. I think he has to try to get as many minutes as possible out of the lineups that are working. And those lineups in this series are basically the starting lineup, which is, you know, through four games, blowing the Wizards' doors off. They're plus 12.1 per 100 possessions with Lowry, DeRozan, OG Anunoby, Serge Ibaka, and Jonas Valanciunas on the floor. 73 minutes, far and away their most used lineup, and it's been great. And yet, at Casey continues at times to have a crisis of confidence, it seems, in Valanciunas, especially late in games. You know, didn't play in the fourth quarter of Game 4, and that's, I think, a miscalculation, if only because there just aren't a whole lot of other lineups that have proven really successful in this series. Mm-hmm. One of them, as you mentioned, is one that has been, in more limited minutes, only 13 minutes to this point, is that Lowry and the bench lineup. That has been a haymaker lineup for the Raptors for years, mm-hmm. sort of no matter what the other players on the second unit are. When you get Lowry on the floor with another creator, in the past it was guys, you know, maybe like Gravis Vasquez, Lou Williams at times. Now it's DeLon Wright, Fred VanVleet. You get a shooter out there in C.J. Miles to space the floor, and bigs, Jakob Poeltl and Pascal Siakam, who can rebound the ball, who can handle different defensive lineups. Pascal Siakam saw a bunch of time on John Wall last game, you know, a versatile big defender. I would expect to see a little bit more of that. Poeltl can, you know, is a sort of a deft passer, can finish around the rim, and you know, can rebound the ball. Has had some trouble fouling in this series, and you know, sometimes at points it's looked like John Wall just sort of sees, you know, a bullseye on Poeltl's chest when he's in the game. Like, I'm going to go right at that dude in the pick and roll. But still, like, that has been Lowry plus the bench, where you get Lowry as like a, you know, a guy who can share ball handling responsibility and shoot, and with some more the floor spread a little bit, has been an excellent lineup for the Raptors for years. And I feel like at this point Casey has to just lean, we're going to play a ton of the starting lineup, we're going to try to steal minutes when we can to give Lowry a breather, with DeRozan center lineups, but those lineups have not been good. DeRozan in the bench is getting blown up in this series. They've got, you know, they have to, you know, this might be the time to ride Kyle Lowry for big minutes. They haven't had to do it a lot this year. Part of the reason they wanted to reorient their team was to reduce the workload on DeRozan and Lowry, and especially Lowry during the regular season. Mm-hmm. Lowry bristled at it a little in the early going, but it wound up being successful. You know, this is why you cut down the minutes over the course of the year, so that you can ride those guys now.
Right.
And it feels like that might be the answer it certainly would be a reasonable move for Casey to make at this point, to say, you know, it's a best of three and we need our best stuff now, and this is when I'm going to ride Lowry for big minutes.
Mm-hmm. Well, flip side of the series, have you ever seen anyone protest a foul call harder than Bradley Beal protested that final foul in Game 4?
I mean, it's not a long list, and that's really saying something, considering, you know, I think that there are times where NBA fans of a certain stripe, I guess maybe that's one way to say it, or maybe people who aren't really NBA fans but who turn up every once in a while and go like, see man, everybody's traveling constantly and everybody's palming the ball and everybody's complaining about everything. This is why I watch the Big Ten. And you're like, all right, thanks, dude. Go do something else. I don't know. Mow your lawn. But there is a point to some degree when you watch some of these games, and it's like everybody is mad about every call, and nobody can understand how they could possibly have been called for a foul. Bradley Beal might add a point on that one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a tough whistle, and he sort of made a meal out of it. But I think, listen, everything's bigger in the playoffs, and you can certainly understand it. But our guy Michael Lee wrote a good piece after Game 4, where, you know, the message that came out, that was a moment where the Wizards could have buckled a little bit. The Wizards are a pretty, they're a complicated and emotional team. And in some of those minutes, you know, where things are up in the air, they can buckle, and they didn't. Bradley Beal went to the bench and said, like, listen, we're not losing this game regardless. And John Wall said, you're damn right. And then they went out and they finished the job. And that's, that could wind up being a very big turning point there, if for no other reason than maybe, the epic method acting of Bradley Beal in that moment really seemed to inspire the troops.
So, in terms of these series right now, I'm going to put you on the spot. We have a couple teams three teams who have advanced to the next round of the playoffs. Of course, we didn't get to the Western Conference here. We covered that last week, but Golden State is in the second round. The New Orleans Hornets are in the second round. Philadelphia 76ers, we just got to, are in the second round. Who's going to join them? Who's going to make it out of these series in the East and then in the two series in the West we didn't cover? You figure Utah and Houston are pretty comfortably favored, given that they're 3-1. But do you think it'll be chalk? Do you think it'll be Houston? And now that Utah's up 3-1, it'll be Houston and Utah joining them in the second round in the West. Let's start there.
Yeah, I do think that. I think that Houston eliminated basically any hope that the Wolves had with that 50-point third quarter in Game 3. Like, that was just, oh, right, this is who we are, and this is who you are, and goodbye. I think that was sort of, you know, thank you very much for playing and have a nice summer. And then with the, like, Oklahoma City is one of the more maddening teams. We talked earlier about sort of the difficulty in getting a bead on the Bucks and the Thunder. It's weird. Like, I think at this point, I maybe came to this point late in the season where my take of, like, I don't understand who the Thunder are supposed to be was like, oh, then I know who the Thunder are. The Thunder are a team who don't know who they're supposed to be. And the Thunder are a, like, a team that careens back and forth from looking like they can dismantle a world-beating, you know, Golden State team, or they can embarrass the Cavs on national TV and then look for three straight games like they've never played together. And I think we've seen that in this series. And, you know, I think the only upset pick I made going into the playoffs was, I think, and I mean, upset being a relative term, I thought the Jazz were going to win in six, because, like, I know who the Jazz are and who the Jazz have been for 3 months. And that's a really, really good team. And the Thunder just have not been consistently good enough and have shown a tendency to implode when things got tough. Mm-hmm. And I think I think we saw that. It would not surprise me if they won game five on their home court to send it back to Utah, but I don't see the Thunder staying together for three more games and having enough answers to the questions that the Jazz have been able to pose over the last three games to survive this series. So the chalk goes out, I think those series go the way that we've mm-hmm. seen them go so far in the West. I have to continue to pick the Cavs, not because I picked them before the start of the series, but because I need to see the Pacers win one of these games. Like, when LeBron puts them to the decision, I have to see them win it. Because I don't know that I believe that they're going to do it. Until proven otherwise, I'm going to keep doing that. And then in Toronto, like, this is more of a hopeful thing. And, you know, no, I mean, no disrespect to the Wizards and their fans, but, like, I really don't want the abiding storyline coming out of this matchup to be like, no matter what, the Raptors will never escape these ghosts. I can't handle, you know, that being the consistent narrative with this team. Like, and that the Wizards can just, like, kind of be a garbage fire for 6 months and then be like, yeah, but when the playoffs start, they're a playoff team. Like, we need different stories, I think. And I'd like for the story that comes out of that series to be the Raptors got pushed and the Raptors got shaken, but then the Raptors, you know, doubled down on who they've been, and there's reason to hope for something better moving forward. I'd like to see that be the story that comes out of it. So that's the way I'll keep picking.
All right. Well, Dan Devine, always a pleasure to have you on the Bill Barnwell Show. Where can people check out more of what you're doing during the NBA playoffs?
You can find me on Twitter at YourManDevine. You can find my work at Yahoo Sports, at Yahoo Sports NBA on Twitter. All of our stuff's there. Stuff from me, Ben Rohrbach, my colleague, Shams Charania, and Chris Mannix and Michael Lee, the whole gang, working very hard through the postseason. You can very rarely find me asleep and in bed at this point, as round one just continues to break me. And apparently now you can find me on any ESPN podcast that will have me.
So excited to hear you on Fantasy Focus, covering the fantasy implications of the NFL draft in the weeks to come. But Dan Devine, always a pleasure to have you here on the show.
Thanks so much, Bill.
All right. Thanks so much to our guest, Dan Devine, for talking the NBA playoffs. We're going to come back with another show this week, a rare two-show offseason week. But NFL draft is coming up, so we have to talk about the first round of the NFL draft. We're going to get to that on Friday, possibly with a very special guest. I don't want to spoil things, but there could be some particularly exciting conversation to come when it comes to the NFL draft. So check us back out on Friday. More Bill Barnwell Show to come.